to the history of Little Europe. Episode 1.20, Operation Tannenbaum. Last time, we covered the interwar years for the Swiss state as it underwent rapid societal and political upheaval. In this episode, we will watch as the now fragile Swiss state is forced to endure the greatest military conflict of all time. In this episode, I'm going to focus mostly on the military and geopolitical aspects of World War II, because in scripting this out, I found it difficult to put it alongside the social and domestic in a single episode. For the purpose of clarity, we will double back and cover all of that stuff next week. Following the outbreak of World War II is an often unmentioned period of history known as the Phony War. It's worth remembering that while Germany invaded Poland in September 1939, it took them until May of the next year to invade France. That left a better part of a year during which almost no major fighting occurred. It is often forgotten that part of the reason France and Belgium were so rapidly enveloped was that they had assumed the conflict was dying down and had gotten cold feet. But this French decline in buildup was in sharp juxtaposition to the state of Switzerland. At the outbreak of World War II in 1939, Switzerland immediately began to mobilize for a possible invasion. The transition into wartime was smooth and caused less controversy than in 1914. The country was fully mobilized in only 3 days. By the 3rd of September, 430,000 combat troops and 210,000 in support services, 10,000 of whom were women, had been mobilized. Parliament placed these newly raised troops under the command of one Henri Guisson and awarded him the position of general. Henri Guisson is something of an entity in Swiss history. He is probably best compared to Winston Churchill. Both had some controversial stances, and both have seen their image slightly degraded over time, but both are wildly popular within their respective countries for effectively leading them through the coming years of crisis. Guisson's appointment as general came despite his membership in the Fédération Patriotique Suisse, an organization supportive of cordial relations with Nazi Germany. However, his time in command was more than anything characterized by conflict with this group, and such affiliations slipped away over the course of the war. Whereas the government preferred an understated and politically riskless neutrality, Guisson, charged with actually preventing invasion, opted to call for more determined resistance. Rather than rely on diplomatically preventing invasion, he would go out of his way to make an invasion as unappealing and difficult as possible. After the Battle of France, Germany found documents proving that Guisson had secretly been making military preparations with France, despite Swiss neutrality. While this made sense in the context of German aggression, it was very politically risky and represented a very typical example to be seized upon by Germany to justify aggression, such as occurred prior to the German invasion of the Netherlands in World War II. With the invasion of France came the conclusion of the Phony War, but it was also the moment during which the Swiss battle plan saw its greatest strength. While Germany and Italy were able to spend the next 2 years mopping up Western and Central Europe, Switzerland's unique defense capabilities made it the only real contender for strong resistance, and thus the German war machine never focused on it. This resistance can be best expressed in a speech made by General Guisson. On the 25th of July, 1940, he delivered a historic address to the entire Swiss officer corps assembled on the Rütli, a location charged with symbolism in Swiss romantic nationalism by virtue of it being identified as the site of the Rütlisführer of 1291. He made it very clear that Switzerland would resist any Nazi invasion. He told them that if they ran out of bullets, they were to resort to the bayonet. He said Switzerland would defend itself against any invader and would never surrender. Given the decentralized structure of the Swiss state, the surrender of a president or capital could be ignored. Indeed, he instructed Swiss citizens to regard any surrender broadcast as enemy lies and resist to the end. Over the course of the coming months, General Guisson developed his famous Réduite Nationale concept, according to which the Swiss army would have retreated into the Alps relatively soon if attacked, but would have kept up resistance based on some sort of guerrilla tactics from there. The Swiss paramilitary organization, Action Nationaler Widerstand, formed from contacts between selected army figures and conservative civilian circles, had the explicit task to persuade the citizen population to resist invaders. And all of this really would be put to the test, as numerous times throughout the war, the Axis powers prepared for such an invasion. In a meeting held with Benito Mussolini and the Italian foreign minister in June 1941, Hitler stated his opinion on Switzerland quite plainly. Quote, "Switzerland possessed the most disgusting and miserable people and political system. The Swiss were the mortal enemies of the new Germany." End quote. In a later discussion, the German foreign minister, Johann von Ribbentrop, directly alluded to the possibility of carving up Switzerland between the two Axis powers. Quote, "On the Deutsches query, whether Switzerland, as a true anachronism, had any future, the Reich foreign minister smiled and told the Duce that he would further have to discuss this with the Führer." In August 1942, Hitler further described Switzerland as, quote, "a pimple on the face of Europe," and as a state that no longer had a right to exist, denouncing the Swiss people as a misbegotten branch of German folk. From a Nazi viewpoint, Switzerland, as a small, multilingual, decentralized democracy, where German speakers felt more of an affinity with their French-speaking fellow Swiss citizens than towards their German brothers across the border, was the antithesis of the racially homogeneous and collectivized Führer state. Hitler also believed that an independent Swiss state had come into existence at a time of temporary weakness of the Holy Roman Empire, and now that the German power had been reestablished after the takeover of the National Socialists, an independent country of Switzerland had become obsolete. Although Hitler despised the democratically minded German Swiss as the wayward branch of the German people, he still acknowledged their status as Germans. Furthermore, the openly pan-German political aims of the Nazi Party called for the unification of all Germans into a greater Germany, which included the Swiss people. Indeed, the first goal of the National Socialist program sought the creation of a pan-German state, and the existence of Switzerland flew in the face of that. In their maps of Greater Germany, German textbooks included the Netherlands, Belgium, Austria, Bohemia, Bavaria, the German-speaking parts of Switzerland, and Western Poland from Danzig to Krakow. Ignoring Switzerland's status as a sovereign state, these maps frequently showed its territory as a German state. The author of one of these books, Ewald Bons, explained, quote, "Quite naturally, we can count you Swiss as offshoots of the German nation, along with the Dutch, the Flemings, the Lorrainers, the Alsatians, the Austrians, and the Bohemians. One day, we will group ourselves around a single banner, and whoever shall wish to separate us, we will exterminate." End quote. Various Nazis were vocal about the German intent to, quote, "expand Germany's boundaries to the furthest limits of the Holy Roman Empire and even beyond." End quote. Germany started planning the invasion of Switzerland, codenamed Operation Tannenbaum, on the 25th of June, 1940, the day after France surrendered. After the armistice with France, Hitler demanded to see plans for the invasion of Switzerland. Franz Halder, the head of Oberkommando des Heeres, recalled, quote, "I was constantly hearing of outbursts of Hitler's fury against Switzerland, which, given his mentality, might have led at any minute to military activities for the army," end quote. Captain Otto Wilhelm Kurt von Menges in OKH submitted a draft plan for the invasion. General Wilhelm Ritter von Lieb and the 12th Army would conduct the attack. Lieb himself personally reconnoitered the terrain, setting the most promising invasion routes and paths of least resistance. Menges noted in his plan that Swiss resistance was unlikely and that a non-violent Anschluss was most likely the result. He would write, quote, "With the current political situation in Switzerland, it might accede to ultimatum demands in a peaceful manner, so that, after a warlike border crossing, a rapid transition to a peaceful invasion must be assured." End quote. The German plan continued to undergo revision until October, when the 12th Army submitted its fourth draft. The original plan had called for 21 German divisions, but that figure was downsized to 11 by the OKH. Halder himself had studied the border areas and concluded that the Jura frontier offered no favorable base for attack. Quote, "Switzerland rises in successive waves of forest-covered terrain across the axis of an attack. The crossing points on the River d'Albs and the border are few. The Swiss frontier position is strong." He decided, on an infantry feint in the Jura in order to draw out the Swiss army, and then cut it off in the rear, as he had done in France. With 11 German divisions and roughly 15 more Italian divisions prepared to enter from the south, the Axis plans were to invade Switzerland with somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000 men. For reasons that are still uncertain, Hitler never ordered the invasion. One theory is that a neutral Switzerland would have been useful to hide Axis gold and to serve as a refuge for war criminals in case of defeat. This may also explain Germany's continued recognition of Switzerland's neutrality. One simpler explanation is that there would have been little strategic gain in conquering Switzerland, while a drawn-out and costly mountain war might well have ensued. Although the Wehrmacht feigned moves against Switzerland in its offensives, it never attempted to invade. After D-Day, Operation Tannenbaum was indefinitely put on hold. While the ground front proved to be the quietest throughout the duration of the conflict, the air was a different story. During the Battle of France, German aircraft violated Swiss airspace at least 179 times. Across several air incidents, the Swiss shot down 11 Luftwaffe aircraft between the 10th of May 1940 and the 17th of June, while suffering the loss of the three of their own aircraft. Germany protested diplomatically on the 5th of June 1940, and with a second note on the 19th of June 1940, which contains explicit threats. Hitler was especially furious when he saw that German equipment was being used to shoot down German pilots. On the 20th of June 1940, the Swiss Air Force was ordered to stop intercepting planes violating Swiss airspace. Swiss fighters began instead to force intruding aircraft to land at Swiss airfields. Anti-aircraft units still operated. Later, Hitler and Hermann Göring sent saboteurs to destroy Swiss airfields, but these were captured by Swiss troops before they could cause any damage. Allied aircraft intruded on Swiss airspace throughout World War II. In total, 6,304 Allied aircraft violated Swiss airspace during the war. Some damaged Allied bombers returning from raids over Italy and Germany would intentionally violate Swiss airspace, preferring internment by the Swiss to becoming prisoners of war. Over 100 Allied aircraft and their crews were interned in this manner. They were subsequently put up in various ski resorts that had been emptied from lack of tourists due to the war and held until hostilities ended. At least 940 of these American airmen attempted to escape into France after the Allied invasion of Normandy in June 1944 in order to rejoin the conflict. Most managed to escape, but Swiss authorities intercepted 183 internees. Over 160 of these airmen were incarcerated in a Swiss prison camp. The American internees remained there until November 1944, when the Swiss State Department lodged protest against the Swiss government and eventually secured their release. The American military attaché in Bern warned Marcel Pilet-Golaut, Swiss foreign minister, in 1944, that, quote, "the mistreatment inflicted on U.S. aviators could lead to navigation errors during bombing raids over Germany," end quote. Switzerland, surrounded by Axis-controlled territory, also suffered from Allied bombings during the war, most notably from the accidental bombing of Schaffhausen by American aircraft on April 1, 1944. It was mistaken for Ludwigshafen am Rhein, a German town 284 kilometers away. 40 people were killed and over 50 buildings destroyed. The bombing limited much of the leniency the Swiss had shown toward Allied airspace violations. Eventually, the problem became so bad they declared a zero-tolerance policy for violation by either Axis or Allied aircraft and authorized attacks on American aircrafts. Victims of these mistaken bombings were not limited to Swiss civilians, but included the often confused American aircrews shot down by the Swiss fighters, as well as several Swiss fighters shot down by American airmen. In February 1945, 18 civilians were killed by Allied bombs dropped over Stein am Rhein, Pfalz, and Raths. Arguably the most notorious incident came on the 4th of March 1945, when Basel and Zurich were accidentally bombed by American aircraft. The attack on Basel's railway station led to the destruction of a passenger train, but no casualties were reported. A B-24 Liberator dropped its bomb load over Zurich, destroying two buildings and killing five civilians. The crew believed they were attacking Freiburg in Germany. As John Helmreich points out, the pilot and navigator, in choosing a target of opportunity, quote, missed the marshalling yard they were aiming for, missed the city they were aiming for, and even missed the country they were aiming for, end quote. The Swiss, although somewhat skeptical, reacted by treating these violations of their neutrality as accidents. The United States was warned that single aircraft would be forced down and their crews would still be allowed to seek refuge, while bomber formations in violation of airspace would be intercepted. While American politicians and diplomats tried to minimize the political damage caused by these incidents, others took a more hostile view. Some senior commanders argued that as Switzerland was, quote, full of German sympathizers, an unsubstantiated claim, it deserved to be bombed. General Henry H. Arnold, commanding general of the U.S. Army Air Forces, even suggested that it was the Germans themselves who were flying captured Allied planes over Switzerland in an attempt to gain a propaganda victory. From 1943 onwards, Switzerland stopped American and British aircraft, mainly bombers, overflying Switzerland on 9 occasions. A grand total of 36 Allied airmen were killed. In the end, through a fierce policy of militant neutrality, Switzerland avoided any conflict throughout the war. It is not unreasonable to assume that was it not for the efforts of Henri Guisan, Switzerland would have been another in a long line of Nazi casualties. Much of this legacy continues on to today, where service in the army is mandatory for all male citizens, mountains still contain miles of military tunnels, strategic artillery is still hidden in barns, and up until recently, every bridge in and out of the country was rigged with explosives. As for Henri Guisan, he would enjoy the remainder of his life in peace, passing away in 1960 as a national hero. Next time, we will cover the political and social situation within Switzerland during the war. Until then, share the show, rate the show, subscribe to the show, send me emails at historyoflittleeurope@gmail.com, and until next time, posegnanie, ciao, and goodbye.